This is the last lecture, and we have our last two seminars on Thursday morning, so remember those. Today's lecture, if you can think that far back, carries on from where the last lecture left off. We left off with Britain, in North America certainly, at the absolute zenith of its power, controlling all of eastern North America from the Mississippi to the Atlantic and from the Arctic to the tropics. This lecture is about how this all falls apart and why it falls apart so quickly. The end of the French Indian War in 1763 to the America's Declaration of Independence in 1776, just 13 years, a very rapid period of change. So what I want to explain today is like why this happened and why it's happened so quickly. And why, despite what you would think of as the obvious reasons for Britain and America to have common cause and be friends and be allies, why that doesn't happen. Why these two parent-child siblings, I don't know how you would describe the relationship, why they can't get along. So I'm going to talk quite a bit about events, which are important, but don't get too bound up by the events. I'm also going to talk about ideas and how ideas influenced the American Revolution. In case you've forgotten it, this is what America looked like after the French Indian War. The dark pink is the areas that were actually effectively under British control, British administration, in terms of their population being mainly European. The light pink is the bit that is now added to that dark pink bit, but effectively is occupied by Indians. The yellow bit is nominally Spanish, though there are very, very few Spanish people actually there. This is one of those old-fashioned maps. If you ever look at maps that were drawn up in the 50s, or even like in the 19th century, the pink bits of the globe were always the British bits. So when you saw these pink maps and all of half of Africa and India and Australia were all pink and Canada, that was the British colour. And I think this map dates from that, perhaps from that period. In a way, the war itself causes the first bit of instability and the first breakdown of the relationship. And it's mainly about money. The war is really expensive. It's expensive mainly for Britain, because it's Britain that's shouldered the lion's share of the funding of the army, the navy, and it's not done this by having vast hoards of gold, which it has spent on the military. What it's done is that it has borrowed the money through the national debt. We're used to our government borrowing money on the financial markets, issuing bonds, national savings accounts. That's all government debt. It's guaranteed government debt because the government can always come and take your money away in taxes and pay it back. Therefore, it's always seen as like rock-solid debt. But it's not a good idea to have too much debt, because then you're basically taxing to repay debt rather than taxing to spending on anything else. This single war, the Seven Years' War, doubles Britain's national debt to £150 million. That's bad enough. The consequence, of course, of kicking the French out of North America is that you suddenly have a very large geographic area, that map showed you, in which that is now nominally British, but which doesn't have any British settlers, and you've got to think, well, how is Britain going to incorporate this new territory into the empire effectively? How is it going to police it? How is it going to make it into a proper imperial territory rather than just a line on a map? The war, of course, by defeating France, by getting rid of France, is getting rid of a common enemy in North America. The Spanish, nobody really takes the Spanish threat desperately seriously by 1763. The French, they do take seriously. Getting rid of the French means that the British and the Americans no longer have that unifying force, that unifying enemy, that opposing force. I mean, it's a bit like America and Russia during the Second World War. They're unified while they have Germany to defeat. Once Germany is defeated, they don't have that enemy to fight against anymore, and their own relationship fractures. So how are you going to police this new territory? Well, you're going to put troops there. Troops which can keep Indians and white settlers apart, and could perhaps also defend the frontier against the Spanish. Maybe the Spanish have got an idea that they'd like a bit of that new North American territory. Maybe they'd like to make a few inroads into that. Well, putting troops in North America is a solution. But on the other hand, what you don't want to do is what New England did in the 17th century, which is spread out too quickly. So you've got a very geographically dispersed population. You don't want that either, because, again, that makes your white population very easy to pick off by Indians or Spanish or whoever. So you try and control white settlement by limiting it near the coast until it's ready to be pushed further west. And to try and offset the national debt, to try and pay some of it back, then you raise extra revenue through taxation. And the obvious place to raise that revenue is in the colonies, because when you compare the average British taxpayer and the average American taxpayer, the average British taxpayer is paying far more in taxes than the average American. And it's a very logical argument. You want to raise money to pay back the debt caused by a war that was fought mainly for America's benefit, and to police a territory that is mainly in North America, and therefore, surely it's only fair that at least some of the costs should be met by people living in North America. Sounds very sort of sensible and logical when I say it like that, but it certainly wasn't perceived in the 18th century as anything like that. At the same time, you've got to think about how American Americans are. Are they still thinking of themselves as British people who happen to live in North America, or are they starting to think of themselves as Americans? And if so, what does that term mean? The majority of the white-born population, of course the majority of black population as well, is not British-born by the mid-18th century. It's Creole, as in it's born in the Americas. And in some of the oldest parts of North America, Virginia, New England, people are on their fifth and sixth generation of settlers. These are people who've got long-established roots in North America now. And of course, a lot of these people aren't even ethnically British anymore. They've come from Holland, they've come from France, the French Huguenots, remember. Protestant dissenters coming from various parts of Europe. And of course, by the 1760s, 1770s, there's about 500,000 African slaves who've come direct from Africa. Why do these people leave Britain? Well, think back to our lectures on the 17th century. Why do people leave? Why do they migrate? Well, part of the reason they leave is because they're missing something. They feel there's something missing in British society, whether it's religious toleration, whether it's economic opportunity, social liberalism, whatever they think is missing in British society, they're hoping to find in America. And so they're leaving out of sense of dissatisfaction, to some extent. You wouldn't leave Britain if your life was wonderful and you had everything you ever wanted, never dreamed of, then there's no reason to leave. So you've got to think about that. People who leave to go to America have an inbuilt sense of dissatisfaction. You know, even if it's just with the weather, they've got that sort of sense of, there's something wrong. Also think about the lecture on the Great Awakening, about how the Great Awakening was this pan-colonial event, very important in the Americas. It affected the lives of thousands and thousands of people. Something else that people talk about, forging American identity. And the life of an American, a North American, in whatever walk of life they did, farming, artisan work, lawyer, whatever, is quite different from living in England. Remember we talked about culture and high culture? The standard of living is very high in North America. Life expectancy is high. Number of children is very high. All these things are quite different from in England. And then you've got the problem of control. Ever since William III ascended the throne in 1688-89, during the Glorious Revolution, British control over the North American colonies had been what you might call loose. Sometimes it's described as laissez-faire. Let things be. It's sort of a laissez-faire type of government, which means that people in Britain... Governments in Britain aren't that interested in what's happening in America in terms of its internal dynamics, its internal politics. It's only interested in the wider imperial vision. What can America bring to the war against France, for instance? And so how Americans govern themselves and rule themselves, they aren't really that interested in. Colonies such as those in Massachusetts, Maryland, New York, those people who would join the Glorious Revolution to overthrow James II and overthrow Andros in the Dominion of New England, thought they were doing what their fellow Englishmen were doing in England as well. They were securing for themselves the rights and liberties of Englishmen, the rights to the rule of law, free from arbitrary government, the right to consent to taxation, all those sorts of things are part of the ideology of the Glorious Revolution. And Americans who, even though they weren't in Britain, thought they had gained those rights as well. People living in the American colonies don't think of themselves as a junior partner in the wars against France. They think of them very much as an equal partner with Britain, in that it's the New York militia or the South Carolina militia, the ones who are fighting with British troops against the French. You know, British gains in North America would not have been achievable without American input. And so what you've got during the 18th century, from the 1680s, 1690s onwards, is about 70 or 80 years where American colonies are left to pretty much govern themselves, with very, very light touch government from Britain, and oversight from Britain. This gives them not only a taste of governing for themselves, but it also gives them a lot of experience, and they're able to demonstrate their own competence, that they can govern themselves. They don't need to be nannied, effectively. And sometimes historians talk about these as being all sort of preconditions of independence. You've got a functioning polity that has well established, it has its structures in place. And of course, the problem comes is when Britain tries to reexert control over. It's like a teenager who was, you know, had a bedtime when he was, you know, 15 or 16, and then he goes to university and he comes back and he's 19 or 20, and his parents still say, "Well, I think you should be in bed by 10:30." It's that sort of thing. Well, you know, what are you going to do about it? It's that sort of issue. It's that the Americans think they've grown out of that sort of parent-child relationship, and it's much more a relationship of equals. Any sort of school textbook historian study of the American Revolution will tell you the American Revolution is all about tax. And to some extent it is. It's tax that is the issue which gets Americans going and also sort of quite gets the British going as well, I think, at the same time. As I said, Britain has a debt problem. You know, wars are expensive. Just witness the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan. You know, every time they fire one of those cruise missiles, it's $1 million. So wars have always been expensive. The First World War ended Britain as a great power because it pretty much bankrupted the state. And so Britain embarks on this attempt to raise money in the colonies. And it tries throughout the 1760s and 1770s to raise at least some revenue that will be put in towards colonial defence. And all of these attempts to raise revenue are resisted. And they're resisted because the principle that had been first asserted by the Puritan rebellion against Charles I and reasserted and reaffirmed by the Glorious Revolution against James II had been that the people give their consent to taxation. That is how governments work. And the problem is, Americans have no direct representation in Britain, and therefore measures passed by Westminster raising revenue in the colonies are seen by Americans as being a symbol of arbitrary government because they've not consented to their own taxation. The British Parliament responds to this by saying, well, you know, we fully agree with the idea that you don't tax without being given the consent of the people. However, we are the people. Parliament is the people. Parliament isn't arbitrary government. Parliament isn't a monarchy or an absolute ruler. Parliament is an elected body, and therefore it can't rule arbitrarily. What you have there is virtual representation in Britain. You have virtual representation in Westminster. Because it's completely impractical. Neither Americans nor the British think that it's possible for the colonies to elect, you know, some MPs and then send them to London to get them to vote on things. Because the time lag between, you know, votes and an electorate, you know, 6 months, and there's no way that MP effectively could be responsible for his electorate. And Americans don't want to be represented in Parliament in Britain. They say, well, we've got perfectly adequate governments in America. Why should we, you know, be represented in Britain? We don't need that. But this whole issue of bypassing the colonial legislatures, of Britain, the British Parliament of Westminster asserting its supremacy, the idea that it is the supreme parliament, it's, you know, the parliament of parliaments. It doesn't matter what these colonial governments say, it's these governments that really matter. This idea, Americans say, is completely contrary to the spirit of the Glorious Revolution. And so you've got two very different perceptions of the problem. One seeing it as arbitrary enslavement, or they often talk about, you know, government, these measures being slavery. And then the British side saying, but this isn't arbitrary at all. This is an elected parliament passing an act for the good of the empire. Although there are some measures before 1765, the one that really kicks off everything is the Stamp Act of 1765. The Stamp Act is an act that says every piece of official paper or printed paper, every government document, every legal document, every publication, every newspaper has to have a stamp. And the stamp will be paid at the duty of one penny. But you think every piece of paper, every piece of proper paper has to have a stamp on it. Very quickly could raise quite a lot of money. If you buy a house, you'll pay stamp duty on it. You don't get anything for your tax, you just pay tax in government. So if you buy a house that's worth £200,000, for instance, you pay tax at 1% on that price, and you pay the government £2,000 for the privilege of moving house. Well, the Stamp Act is exactly the same thing. It's just a way of raising revenue. And the Stamp Act had existed before. So it's not a new measure, but they hadn't existed or been applied to the Americas before. Just a new measure of the Americas. What happens in 1765 is that a lot of the official publications, like newspapers, just don't print. There's just gaps in the printing presses. People just don't want the printing stuff rather than pay the tax. When ships arrive bearing the stamps, then they're confiscated or destroyed. When people are appointed to be stamp distributors or stamp collectors, then they're targeted by mobs, their homes are burned down, the individuals are tarred and feathered. A lot of people are persuaded to not accept such, you know, high, you know, offices. And so, very quickly, you've got an organised response against the Stamp Act, which makes it completely unworkable. It's just not raising any money. And once it's not raising any money, then there's no point in having it anymore. There's a change of government in Britain. The Earl of Chatham, William Pitt, returns as Prime Minister. Pitt, who had been Prime Minister during parts of the French Indian War, very popular in America, oversees the repeal of the Stamp Act, saving America. I mean, people put up statues to Pitt. In places like Charleston, South Carolina. It was revoked in 1766, but as a rider, in a way, as a face-saving measure, then the British Parliament passes the Declaratory Act, and the Declaratory Act says that although it is repealing the Stamp Act, it reserves the right to itself to make laws for America in, quote-unquote, all cases whatsoever. A lot of people in America think, oh, well, it was just a way of keeping their own population, their own MPs happy. Don't really mean it. But, you know, they did. A year later, they pass a whole load of import duties on goods such as paper, glass, lead and tea. And they hope to get away with import duties because import duties had existed for quite a long time, going right back to the Navigation Act in the 1660s as a way of regulating trade. And Americans had paid import duties, or rather they'd paid some import duties and spent a lot of time smuggling goods so they didn't have to pay import duties. But they hadn't revolted about import duties before. However, following on from the Stamp Act, these new import duties are seen immediately as a revenue-raising exercise. They're nothing about regulating trade, they're all about making money. And so the colonies get together and they organise a non-importation agreement, saying they are not going to buy these goods, and also they're just not going to buy goods, period, from Britain until these duties are repealed. And in the 2 years following the passage of the called the Townshend Act in 1767, trade between Britain and America halves. And the British merchants go absolutely bananas, because the people in Britain who make their money by selling to the Americans, and it's such a huge market, remember 2.5 million people living in America, you can't afford to ignore that kind of market. The people who are hurting are the British merchants. And the other thing that's happening is that Americans are defaulting on their credit notes in Britain. And so there's a lot of business pressure on the government to get rid of these duties because of its effect on trade. And eventually they get rid of most of them. They leave the one on tea, which we'll come back to in a minute. But the basic thing to remember about taxation is that and you can read all the books on the American Revolution, will go into really mind-numbing detail about every single one of these acts. They all try and raise revenue from the Americans in one way or the other, and they all fail. And that's the most important thing to remember, is that the British Treasury gets no significant income stream, you know, between 1763 and 1776 from the American colonies. This is a very rare example of colonial stamps in the Library of Congress. Not many of these were ever printed, and even fewer survive. And here is a cartoon celebrating the funeral of Miss Amy Stamp, which again is characteristic of the time, people publishing cartoons in satirical papers. The political cartoon in the political magazine is very common in the mid to late 18th century. Let's talk a little bit about individuals, because they are key to the course of the American Revolution. The Revolution is not a mass movement in the sense that it's not an uprising of the people. That would be a gross exaggeration. It is led by generally wealthy, educated, elite people, merchants, lawyers, planters. These are the people, we'll talk about some of the individuals in a second, who we talk about as being the founding fathers of the American Republic. A very, very able and capable generation. Great men. Sometimes almost lifted into sainthood. But it, as I say, it's not a revolution from below, it's a revolution from above. And sometimes some of the books you'll read about the American Revolution talk about it as sort of a conservative movement. It's odd to think of a revolution as conservative, but it's a revolution by elite people to protect rights and privileges which they currently had and which were under threat from British interference. These are people who are used to running their own colonies, they're used to running their own affairs, and they're not used to having people from London come in and interfere and muck it all up. However, they're not stupid enough to think they can have a revolution on their own. No point all the rich, wealthy, elite people and merchants and lawyers and planters saying, yes, let's get together and have a revolution, because, you know, what are they, 5% of the population? If 95% of the population don't give, a toss about it, then they're not going to have any kind of revolution. So they need to take the ordinary people with them. They need to create popular support. And how they do that is really clever. And that's what they're really good at, in the way the British are really, really bad at it. It's the way they get popular support and take it with them. And they're very good about telling people about rights which they probably never even knew they had. And getting them really sort of worked up about it. First and foremost, we have to talk about George Washington. Starts out his career as a soldier in the British Army during the French Indian War, not a very successful soldier, as we said, on the losing side several times. He's a Virginia plantation slave owner, also sometime politician. He serves in both Continental Congresses in 1774 and 1775. He is, in 1775, appointed the commander of Continental Forces by the Continental Congress. He serves as president of the Constitutional Convention and, of course, is first president of the United States. 1797. And if you want to go to his ancestral home, it's in Northamptonshire, Solgrave Manor. It's not that far from that way. If you like it. Benjamin Franklin, the oldest of the founding fathers, born as early as 1706, quartered in Philadelphia, printer by trade, edited the Pennsylvania Gazette, the sort of New York Times of its day, for 20 years. He lived in London for quite a long period of time as the colonial representative in London for a number of different American colonies. And in fact, at one point, when all these rows about taxation were going on, a member of the government said to him, "You're a colonial, how would you get us out of this mess? How would you raise revenue for the Treasury so that we're not so much in debt?" And he went, basically, it's not my problem, it's your problem. He helped to draft and then sign the Declaration of Independence. He served as ambassador to France during the Revolutionary War, which is a crucial role, of course. I'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. He wrote the Treaty of Paris, which ended the American Revolution in 1783. And, of course, he signed the Constitution. After the oldest founding father, the youngest, Thomas Jefferson, Virginia planter, slaveholder, he drafted and he signed the Declaration of Independence. He became third president of the United States, 1801-1809, oversaw things like the Louisiana Purchase, which added most of the Midwest to the United States in 1803. John Adams, who, by some bizarre fate, Jefferson and Adams both died on the same day, July the 4th, the 50th anniversary to the day of the signing of the Declaration of Independence in 1866. He also served in both Continental Congresses and signed the Declaration of Independence. With Franklin, he helped draft the Treaty of Paris. He served as Vice President under Washington and then President for one term between 1797 and 1801. And his relation, but not his brother, I think they were cousins, Samuel Adams, also known for a very tasty beer in Boston, if you ever go to Boston, buy Sam Adams beer. A real agitator, less of a politician. He worked with things like the Sons of Liberty and the Committees of Correspondence, crucial organisations, but he also did sign the Declaration of Independence. So as I said, these people, lawyers, planters, merchants, these people need to take the populace with them. How do they do that? How do they grab the hearts and minds? And they need to work on this particularly hard because there's quite a lot of people in America who, if they're not out and out loyalists and royalists, are at best sort of indifferent to the whole idea of independence, not that keen on it. Well, they do this in a number of ways. They continually stress about their own virtue, the virtue of their cause against Britain, the natural rights that they all have, that they are defending the rights of man. This is a whole sort of Enlightenment thought. That what they're engaged in is a struggle against oppression and slavery, and what the British are trying to do is enslave them, to oppress them. And so you have individuals who are very good about talking to crowds, who are very good about disseminating information, publishing treatises, pamphlets, broadsides about what's going on in Britain, about the latest thing that's gone through Westminster. They don't let the British government get away with anything sort of on the sly, secretly just passing something on the quiet. And as soon as they see the word America publishing any law, they scrutinise it really carefully to see what its meaning is. And they launch a very effective propaganda war to win over the hearts and minds.
And I'll show you some examples in a minute.
And they also published books. Common Sense, published by Thomas Paine in January of 1776, has a specific purpose. There's a lot of books written about the American Revolution, during the American Revolution, defending, for instance, the rights of people to consent to taxation and the right to resist arbitrary government. But Common Sense has one particular purpose, which is to break the loyalty of Americans to the monarchy, which it succeeds very effectively. Sells out, its first print run, and it's reprinted several times. They also use newspapers. Newspapers which have grown up during the 18th century, led by things like the Pennsylvania Gazette, to publicise what's going on in the conflict with Britain, to make sure that one colony isn't isolated, that all colonies share the pain, and therefore all colonies can act with a united front, which is something the British try several times to do, is to pick off, for example, Massachusetts, and just punish Massachusetts in the hope that the others will play ball, but the others sort of joining on Massachusetts' behalf. Corresponding committees also make sure that information flows via letter, using the kind of communication networks that were first created and used during the Great Awakening, tell of religious revivalism. So, as I said, yes, not desperately clear this, but the sort of, what would you call it, peachy colour, are the loyalist areas, and you can see them significantly about New York State, Rhode Island, parts of Virginia, large sections in North Carolina. And these sort of purpley colours are where the war is really fought, in the backcountry of the Carolinas, in New Jersey, and in upstate New York. Those are the real conflicted areas. And this picture, I think, is quite interesting because I showed you some other pictures made by Benjamin West, the American artist. This one he painted in England in 1763. And it shows five Americans, all living in England at the time, all studying at King's College in Cambridge. Three of them went on to be loyalists. Two went on to be leading patriots. And it shows, I think, how loyalism and patriotism fractured family groups, friendships, pitted brothers against brothers, fathers against sons, husbands against wives, and certainly broke friendships as well. And these people who, 10 years previously, had been a group of American young men in England who were friends, had their lives completely in divergent directions 10 years later because of the conflict over the American Revolution. And this is Thomas Paine, and this is his book, Common Sense. Basically saying that independence, freedom from Britain, is only a matter of common sense. It's a very short book. It's worth reading if you haven't read it. The American Revolution uses violence in quite an interesting way, and you might read some things about this. Violence isn't, of course, unknown in America. There's a popular culture of violence. But it's much more organised, much more targeted, and in a way sophisticated during the American Revolution. Riots have specific aims, for instance, to prevent stamps being distributed. And what they tend to do is not get out of control. It's almost like, mob violence is being used as a political weapon. The mob comes out, burns down the house of the stamp distributor, and then it sort of disappears again. And it doesn't then degenerate into general violence, just general ransacking of the town. It's always very, very targeted. Rioting violence brings the revolution to ordinary people in a way that rhetoric and publications tend not to. People who are illiterate, the poor, for instance. Women. Women like nothing more than a good riot. Black people. These are all people who are brought into the orbit of the American Revolution by violence, who are otherwise going to be excluded from it or ignored about it. And the other thing it does is that it puts British troops stationed in America in a really awkward position, because they're not used to dealing with civilians. They're used to fighting the French in set-piece military engagements, where everyone stands still and gets shot at, and you see who wins at the end. Whereas when civilians are there, and they're in your face, and they're pushing you, I mean, do you fire at civilians who are unarmed, or don't you? How far do you let it go before you do fire? And the encounters between military troops and civilians is always awkward and always problematic. You only have to look at Bloody Sunday in Northern Ireland in the 1960s to see that that's true even in the 20th century. And it leads to things like the Boston Massacre of 1770. The Boston Massacre, here depicted by Paul Revere, in a classic piece of American propaganda, shows a formally lined up column of British troops doing volley fire at innocent civilians. And just to add to the gore and the blood, you get somebody with blood pouring out of his head on the floor here. This was a confrontation between a mob and British troops. Somebody starts firing. Isn't known who. But British soldiers certainly think they're being fired at, and therefore they fire into the crowd. And they kill, I think, 6 or 7. Whether that counts as a massacre is perhaps open to debate, but it's depicted as a massacre. And this is produced pretty quickly, and then it's mass-produced, and it's distributed everywhere. And that says, look at British troops, look what they're doing, they're killing innocent civilians, they're killing you, this could have been you on the street. It's a very canny use of propaganda, in an age when this sort of spin was almost unknown. And so we reach the mid-1770s, where you get provocation and you get stubbornness. And both of those two things don't sit together very well. Both the Americans and the British their political leaders are digging themselves into positions which they would find it very difficult to back out of without significant loss of face, or significant humiliation, and making statements which are bold, defiant, angry. And every time the Americans do something, the British respond in a more extreme way. Nobody tries very hard to be conciliatory. Nobody's the voice of reason. Nobody's saying, well, if we just do this, why don't we agree that? Because if the Americans do offer some kind of rational solution to some of the problems, the British aren't interested in listening to these rebels, these colonials, telling them what to do. And equally, if the British try and make overtures, then the Americans often say, well, we're not listening. You've tried it. Too late. And things really kick off in December of 1773. The East India Company, mainly because it hasn't been able to sell tea in America, is losing money. And what it's got in its warehouses in Britain are huge stockpiles of tea. And it reckons that the 6 penny duty on tea is what is depressing sales of tea in America. And so it persuades the British government to halve the duty on tea to thrones. And then it ships over a whole lot of tea to Boston in the hope that it's going to sell it cheaper than it was being sold before. But this is, in a classic example of spin, interpreted as another attempt to force taxation on the Americans. Regardless of the fact that the duty had been cut, it's still a duty, it's still duty tea. And so what happens is that a group of Bostonians, disguised as Mohawk Indians, and there's a whole sort of iconographic story there, where the white disguise yourself as a Mohawk, enter these ships while they're in Boston Harbour, and they throw all the tea overboard. The British are outraged. Not so much for the action itself, but the destruction of property. The tea is worth thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds. And when they hear about it, the response is what the British call the coercive acts, but which the Americans, as they are like, you know, like to do in their spinning way, they call the intolerable acts. And these four acts are the Administration of Justice Act, which basically says that any soldier who's going to be accused or tried for a crime in America would be tried in Britain, and i.e. have a much friendlier jury. The Massachusetts Government Act, which takes away the rights of the Massachusetts government to be elected, and instead the governor and the deputy governor be appointed by Britain. The Boston Port Act, probably the most draconian, which closes the port of Boston until the cost of the tea is being repaid. And finally, the Quartering Act. The Quartering Act is one that forces local populations to support soldiers by putting them up and feeding them. Americans sometimes also include the Quebec Act as one of the intolerable acts. It's not. It just sort of coincidentally was passed at the same time. But remember, the Quebec Act set out a new system of government for the province of Quebec that did not allow for an elected assembly. And a lot of Americans thought that was a blueprint for future changes in, you know, American colonies. And so you've got this impasse in 1774. You've got the British really clamping down hard on Boston in 1774 and hoping that this is going to be, you know, the sort of clip around the ear that the Americans need. And there was a very early engraving of these mohawks chucking the tea in Boston Harbour. Which, as Henry Mack says in Mary Poppins, made the tea undrinkable, even for Americans. Which I always think is one of the best lines in Mary Poppins, but maybe that's just because it's a historical joke. And here's an American take on the Boston Port Bill, which closes the port of Boston, and there's a bit of exploration there about poor old America almost being sort of molested, being raped by these greedy, horrible politicians in Britain. And there's Britannia at the back, hanging her head in shame because of the violation of the rights of Englishmen. Remember, the rights of Englishmen is what the Americans are fighting for. That's what they're trying to get, the rights of Englishmen. Being denied them by Englishmen. You know, a bit of an irony. And this is a British take on the same thing. Here you've got the Continental Congress meeting at the same time, the British magazine. Have the politician using the resolutions of the Continental Congress as toilet paper. So, you've got a gradual but almost inexorable slide into war, and it's. The war effectively starts, not with the Declaration of Independence in 1776, but with the Battles of Lexington and Concord in April 1775. This is where British troops stationed in Boston set out towards Concord to secure, effectively, an arsenal, a government arsenal of weapons for their own use, rather than let them fall into American hands. In both Lexington and Concord, skirmishes break out between local militias and British troops. Again, it's a who shot who first sort of situation. But what's certainly true is that the colonials come off worse in these encounters. But as the troops march like that in columns through the American countryside, and word begins to spread of, you know, these battles where Americans have been killed, then the Americans engage in a long guerrilla campaign against this column, shooting from behind trees and sneaky things like that, setting up ambushes, and they kill quite a lot of that column before they eventually make it back to Boston.
And at the same time, the Second Continental Congress, which is meeting in Philadelphia, basically takes on the whole role of a revolutionary government. They make one final attempt, the olive branch petition, to the king to try and avert a war. But King George III basically isn't interested, and he declares the colonies in open rebellion, which pretty much sets out there's going to be a war, and it's going to be fought in America. Again, very good example of how you spin the Battle of Lexington is you put a whole load of coffins on top of the front page, showing the brutality and cruelty of the British troops, and then you list the dead. Again, these sorts of things are rapidly printed, rapidly circulated. In the summer of 1776, this is Thomas Jefferson drafting the American Declaration of Independence. You don't think of the American Declaration of Independence being an essay, crossings out, insert this, and scribbles all over. But Jefferson wrote it, and then Franklin rewrote bits of it. There's a clause in the draft about slavery, about how slavery is an abomination voiced on the American side of the British. But that's deleted from the final version. Can't be alienating too many southern planters at this time. And this is the final printed version. Again, printed, mass-produced, in broadside, distributed all the way through the American colonies. For those who can't read, you read it from the town hall steps. You make sure people know about these new rights, these new republic they're all part of, the steps that have been taken in their name. So, why does the war go the way it does? Well, as I said a minute ago, the Americans don't fight fair. They don't stand there like the French do and wait to be shot. They fight sneakily like the Indians do, who they, of course, learned it from. And very effective it is, too, in the wildernesses and the woods and swamps of America. So all the British military power, which is based on set-piece battles, is pretty much useless. Whenever they do meet the Americans in set-piece battles, they tend to win. But Americans, very carefully, don't have those sort of set-piece battles. There are some good generals on the American side. Washington's crossing of the Delaware in winter, when traditionally no army fought between sort of October and March or April. Again, he's very skillful. The British certainly would have assumed that Washington would have stayed where he was in his winter encampment, and therefore could be attacked again in the same place in the spring, and Washington just sort of turns up somewhere else. The French, of course, haven't gone away. Smarting from the being kicked out of North America in 1763, they're very quick to offer North Americans support through troops, through ships, through generals, and through money. They are very important, especially the Navy, because the Navy cuts off some British resupply to troops. It's the French blockade of Chesapeake Bay that means that Cornwallis can't be resupplied at Yorktown and has to surrender. The British don't fight the war desperately well. In fact, they fight it fairly badly. They also tend to view all Americans as rebels, rather than seeing the reality, which is that quite a lot of Americans were, only very loosely allied to the Patriot cause and could easily have been won back over to loyalism. If the right things have been said and the right actions have been taken. But they tend to sort of go in heavy-handed and treat all Americans as rebel scum and therefore alienate lots of potential supporters. And also you've got a problem with fighting a war 4,000 miles away from your supply lines, whereas the Americans are fighting at home and they've got that kind of closeness to their supplies. But it's a classic, guerrilla war. If you want to see why Britain lost the American War of Independence, well, look at the Americans fighting in Vietnam in the 1960s and 1970s. Look at the Russians fighting in Afghanistan in the 1980s. You can't win a guerrilla war. You can't win a war against the population. You win a war against an army, but you can't win a war against the population. Eventually, you'll give up. And that's what the British did. They could have carried on fighting after Yorktown, but they sort of give up. There's not the stomach for the fight anymore. They had plenty more troops they could have sent. They still held New York, they still held Charleston. They could have carried on, But they didn't, there wasn't really the political will in England to do it. Here's Washington celebrating a key American victory at Saratoga in upstate New York in 1777. Crossing the Delaware with all the ice. Cornwallis' surrender at Yorktown in 1781. Yorktown, incidentally, about 10 miles from Jamestown in Virginia. So, you know, America ends and America begins, you know, in a very, very small, same peninsula in Virginia. This is what the new United States looks like after the Treaty of Paris in 1783. Spain gets Florida back as sort of a reward. Canada, well, the Americans have tried several times during the war to invade Canada, all unsuccessfully. But all the bits south of the Great Lakes and east of the Mississippi, apart from Florida, becomes the new United States. And we have a new flag. 13 stars and 13 stripes for 13 colonies. And colonial history has come to an end. So here we are, the end of an era.